Welcome to the latest episode in the Enterprise Time Security Podcast series. My name is Ian Murphy, and my guest today is Matt Locke, Technical Director at Varonis. Today, we're going to be talking about Emotet, the banking malware that continues to evolve and refuses to go away. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Ian. Good afternoon. I'm Matt Locke. I'm a Technical Director of Varonis. I work for an organization that is involved in helping organizations protect data at scale. And as you can imagine, it's a bit of a challenge nowadays.
Emotet, it's a piece of malware that's been around since 2014. Can you give us a better insight into what it is and what we actually know about it?
Yes, of course. Emotet is two things, really. It's a strain of malware in itself, but it's also a cybercrime operation based out of Russia. It's been around, as you say, since 2014. It came into the world as a banking Trojan. And that's what most organizations and people regard Emotet as, is a banking Trojan, something that would sit on your machine and harvest credentials for your bank accounts. It would look at browser history. It would be key logging. It would be capturing things and then sending it back to a command and control center in Russia to then harvest that information. But it has evolved over the years. It's grown. It's also evolved into more than just a banking Trojan. It's now used as an initial payload to be able to get a foothold inside an organization. It's been used now as a way of having more targeted and more focused attacks where there are different steps and different objectives and methods that they want to try and undertake to find sensitive data and then steal it. It's being used now by a number of organizations. It provides an infrastructure for different cybercrimes to use that infrastructure to deliver payloads, run ransomware. And we've seen a real surge in the last few months as well. I think it sort of began sort of late July, early August with a targeted spear phishing campaign, and it's evolved massively now.
The evolution to spear phishing is interesting because it's tended to use a lot of malspam over the years. And three bots in particular, why do you think it's begun to evolve into spear phishing?
What we've found out that's been happening over the last few years is they've been harvesting a lot of information. They've obviously been building these botnets now, but they've also been harvesting credentials and emails from attacks that have been happening over the last few years. What they're able to do now is be very, very clever and very targeted with spear phishing emails. One of the techniques we've seen that's been very successful of late is this thing called thread hijacking. This is where they are sending emails that appear to be replies to an email thread that an employee or maybe just a home user has been having with somebody else. It's very easy to trick somebody into thinking that this is perfectly legitimate. This is enabling them to bypass a lot of protection that's in place at the moment. Thread hijacking has this ability to go under the radar. It's enabling them to get footholds very quickly. If I was to receive an email from my boss on an email thread that I've been having a conversation with, I wouldn't think much of it really just to open up the email and look at the document that he sent me. This is how they're suddenly being very successful of late.
But who are they actually targeting with this? Are they now trying to reinvent themselves as a BEC attack?
Quite possibly. The targets that they're going for are typically organizations that hold information that they can monetize. Now, that may account for a lot of organizations, but information that they can sell quickly. They're still employing techniques to capture banking Trojans, but they're also targeting organizations that hold sensitive information, PII or financial information. We've seen a lot of universities and hospitals being targeted as well. It's a lot of research data. They're targeting these organizations that they know that they can then either sell the information off to make money or use that leverage to ask for a ransom to provide a decryption key, because part of the payload is obviously a piece of ransomware. It's very targeted. It's not opportunistic anymore. And we're seeing that not just in the way that the spear phishing campaigns are happening, but also in the techniques of how they're actually disabling and circumventing security controls that these organizations have in place. It's malware that morphs to its environment, and this enables them to be quite targeted in terms of what they're doing.
How much of this is actually written by themselves, and how much is this them working with other groups by which they're renting a set of functions off somebody else and lending their installer and their platform to these other people?
It's both, but certainly the latter we're seeing a lot more of now. Emotet themselves have and are regularly changing the malware that they're using. But as you say, they're also providing this ability for other strains of malware, be it ransomware or reconnaissance or brute force pieces of code, for them to then use their infrastructure. It's got to the point now where the botnets that they hold are enormous. We have to look at an organization like Emotet as a global organization. You know, they have thousands of machines out there. We've seen examples where they are asking for help, asking for assistance to manage the size of the botnets that they have, and also auctioning off and selling off parts of the botnets, along with details about what's been infected and what potential targets can be reached by these botnets and what level of sensitive data these targets are holding. There's a lot of context that they're actually being able to offer off with these infected machines. We're seeing collusion. We're seeing these organizations working together and utilizing the different steps that they have to get footholds to then drop their ransomware code. I imagine there's a proportion of that cost passed off to the infrastructure providers like Emotet.
You talked there about selling off parts of the infrastructure. Are you seeing them selling off the less profitable parts, or are they overburdened, if you like? The botnets have become too big to manage, which is why they're getting rid of bits.
Certainly the latter. Whether they're selling off ones that are less lucrative, possibly. But for example, we saw a botnet of about 10,000 machines being sold off for an Iranian bank only a few weeks ago. That would have some very high value assets, and they actually sort of listed it in terms of the potential targets and the revenue that could be generated from using this botnet. I think they are being a little bit more calculated, and they're actually looking at their estate and carving it up into categories and chunks of how lucrative they can be. Not necessarily the smaller ones, but actually the ones that can be quite targeted. It's got to the point now where these botnets are so vast and so huge. What that means is that when areas get shut down, other areas come to fruition very, very quickly. We saw recently Microsoft had a reasonably successful attempt to try to take down part of the Emotet infrastructure, but I think a big chunk of it suddenly was fired up and included in that botnet. It's a forever moving target, really.
We look for command and control servers. And for some of the groups, these command and control servers are very ephemeral. They pop up, they disappear, but there's always somewhere something in their code that redirects to where the new one will appear. Is Emotet using that same approach, or are we getting closer to understanding its command and control structure?
It's a little bit of both. There is certainly more of a rigid structure in place for known C2 servers that they're communicating to, but they're also using that technique of being able to provide algorithms where they can jump between them. This is what's making it very, very difficult to be able to spot this stuff. It's what I talked about earlier. When we think about these layers of security that we have in place, these are reasonably simple techniques that can bypass these things. Being able to spot an infection by identifying a C2 server IP address is really a very, very small piece of the puzzle. If we're to make any determination that we've actually got an infection here, it comes down to looking at changes in terms of outbound communication and DNS. It's very, very difficult to do with that, because you can imagine the number of DNS requests that happen in a day from an internal organization. Being able to spot periodic communication to one particular IP that isn't categorized is very, very difficult. It's a technique that they're going to utilize for a while now, because it's easy to hide amongst the noise.
I was talking to another security company recently, and we were talking about this challenge of indicators of compromise. Every time we get an alert about a new piece of malware or a successful campaign, vendors very quickly give us hashes, domain names, things that we should be able to set up in our routers or firewalls or blacklists to avoid. But I kind of get the impression from you that that's getting harder and harder to provide enough information for people to begin to block some of these attacks. So what do we do from a defender's perspective?
It's a tricky one. I think the horse has bolted by the time we've received the information. You've got to remember, these are human beings with a high level of intelligence. They know that they have a short window of opportunity. And I'm sure they have designated times of keeping these C2 servers and these blacklisted IPs active. So they're forever changing. But it has to come down to a behavioral piece. You think about the amount of information we have to sift through to be able to spot these things. It's absolutely enormous. It has to come down to a level of automation in terms of monitoring behavior. You talked about blacklists. Blacklists are only as good as the things that are on that list. Everything else is fair game. We have to interpret the activity in a way that allows us to make determinations that there's activity that's gone awry or changes in behavior, but it has to be in correlation with other pieces of activity as well. If we start to see abnormal outbound DNS requests along with a machine that was suddenly being accessed by an account that hasn't accessed it before, those may in themselves be two completely different entities. But if we can have some correlation that can start to join the dots and make a determination that perhaps this machine is trying to laterally move, or there may be some code trying to laterally move, and we can correlate that to this outbound communication to this IP address that we've never seen before, and for all intents and purposes might be all right, but it's starting to build a picture up to me. Suddenly I've got machines talking to an IP, and then there's another machine talking to that IP. But as I say, this is only really achievable if you've got some sort of automation, some sort of machine learning looking at this and just deciphering it in near real time, because otherwise we will be forever updating blacklists.
Many organizations were only just beginning to tune their behavioral analytics while everybody was in the office. They had a reasonable expectation of what all the company IPs were. They had a good chance of working out who their mobile users were. They got a degree of control over the apps, both on-prem apps and apps in the cloud. But everybody's working from home, or a coffee shop, or the back of their car, or halfway up a mountain, quite frankly, wherever they can socially distance and get online. How do we begin to work out what is a good IP address and what isn't? How do we begin to track where that data's going when it's really a bit of Wild West at the moment, with users picking up any cloud storage they want or any collaboration app they want, and companies willing to let them use it in order to keep the business running?
It's really, really difficult. And just before I answer your question, what's also been fascinating with the Emotet and the new variants and the new updates they've released lately is they're actually trying to brute force Wi-Fi networks. They're actually taking advantage of this new remote working that we're having. They can actually jump onto neighboring Wi-Fis to then infect those machines. So how do we possibly implement user behavioral analytics when suddenly we have a total remote workforce? It's very difficult. We have to try and capture as many pieces of telemetry that's going to help us as we can. We have to have an understanding of the roles of the employees that work for us and their level of privilege. That will then determine different types of behavior in terms of the system they interact with. So an admin account typically interact with more administrative-based consoles, and a user would typically interact with their departmental data. We have to understand peer group relationships, and we have to understand what data is sensitive and what isn't. Then it's a question of trying to layer over the top an understanding of what typical normal behavior looks like for that particular employee. You can apply the same level of inspection whether they're remote or whether they're in the office. They may be coming from different locations, but the roles are the same. So the typical day-to-day data activities should be the same. What we are seeing, though, is that those machines that are remote are basically piggybacks for somebody to jump onto the network. They can obfuscate their activity through the noise of what a typical user is generating. When I then connect remotely to my corporate network via a VPN, or I access cloud-based data, we need to look at all the activity from me, and why am I now, at a similar time, then trying to access other applications that I don't access? If you can get to the point where you can make a decision about what looks normal for this particular role, and peer relationships is a really insightful way of being able to determine that, because I don't know what a role is, but I can build up patterns of roles, then you can make a decision that actually this pattern might be behaving in the way that it normally behaves, but it's also behaving in a way that's abnormal to that pattern. And that would certainly suggest a machine that's been compromised and somebody's now starting to leverage the access that they have into that network.
But there are two parts with that. And the first one I'll deal with is this issue of what is normal for that role. If we look around, people are no longer doing just their job. They're helping out other people, or they're taking over parts of somebody else's job who's been furloughed. At the same time, what we would consider as normal for that role, if you are office-based, no longer applies, because with work from home, and I've been doing this since 1990, you fit that work in around when you can. And particularly for multinational organizations, there is no 9-to-5. People now, even in single countries, are no longer working 9-to-5. So a lot of that breaks down. We also have very little interaction with HR as to what defines a role. So how do we tighten that up? And maybe this goes to the issue of a better idea of identity, a better relationship with HR, who are providing us with more information on what a role is, and being able to give us a better view on what people should be able to access. Because after all, stay in a company long enough and you have access to everything in that company.
We have to try and join the dots. When I talk about a role, I'm talking about an interpretation of digital activity that that particular account generates. But wouldn't it, like you say, be lovely to be informed by an HR team that this is a role that we have, and these are the applications, and these are the data sets, and these are the typical levels of confidential information they work with, for example, that this role is going to undertake, then interpret that into a digital-based role to then capture it. That would be wonderful. I don't think we're there yet. It would be hugely advantageous. But like you say, roles can morph and change, and I think we will forever be playing catch up if we can't apply some sort of technological inspection of role deviations. It may be that we combine roles and say this person is now accounting for another type of activity. We're going to watch this account over the next day or so to see other types of behavior. I can then associate with that role that person who was perhaps furloughed. I don't think we're quite there yet.
One of the reasons I mentioned identity is we're talking here about roles and individuals, but actually it's not just the activity of that individual, it's the activity of any device related to that individual. It's the activity of any OT or IoT device on my network. That means identity has to stop being thought of as being something that lives and breathes and should be anything that connects to my network. How do we make that shift with identity, and how do we take role as part of that discussion?
Wow, that's a good question. It's a challenge. It really is a challenge. A lot of it is going to come down to the fundamentals and just trying to implement a least privilege process as much as we can. There has to be sharing of access across devices. But at the same time, it becomes a real challenge when suddenly people are accessing information from a device from a completely different location than they were a few minutes ago. Good example for me would be I have a phone and I'm accessing data via a 4G network. At the same time, my laptop is connected to the VPN and I'm connecting to a different IP, but I'm accessing the same information at very, very slightly different times. You have to make a decision that this is one individual, this is one person, this is one entity doing this, rather than looking at the details. How could that possibly happen? How can they be authenticating from two different places at exactly the same time? There has to be a certain level of intelligence. And as you say, trying to build up this one entity, regardless of device and location and all these other pieces of telemetry that we try and pull in, is a challenge.
But how do we keep that connection secure? As you said, you're using your laptop and your phone. I sit myself with multiple devices and use multiple VPNs. For many companies at the moment, they have absolutely zero insight into the devices that their users have. Part of that is because with BYOD, companies were able to shift the capital expenditure of buying new technology onto their staff. But in doing so, we lost a measure of control, a measure of information. What can be done by organizations to ensure that everything they do is encrypted and therefore not interceptable by malware on that device?
It's a tricky one, but there are techniques that we can do. We've seen it in the past where we can sandbox environments where people connect from remotely, and the resource that they then access can only access within that virtual space on those particular machines. We can incorporate controls on endpoints where an active connection is into the network. Anything else can then not access the internal memory of that resource that's been assigned to run that application. And there are ways of segmenting it off, but there's always going to be that risk of being able to move from one virtual memory space to the other. Things like copying and pasting is always going to be a bit of a challenge. Everything we do in this space has to be layers. We have to do what we can to ensure to the best of our ability that we're controlling the access into that. And if that means I'm dropping an applet or something onto your machine, that then means that everything that you then access runs within a sandbox and it's removed and deleted, you know, it's not accessible afterwards. But at the same time, we have to then monitor activity. We have to look at what they're accessing. When we look at attacks, and the reason why we're talking about Emotet is because data is being taken. regardless of the techniques and the reconnaissance and the lateral movements and the payloads they drop to turn off all different EDRs and endpoints and security layers that we have. The target at the end of it is the data. Whenever I have these conversations, I always try and urge people to really think about what we're trying to protect here. We're trying to protect the data. That must be where we begin. We must know what is of high value to ensure that we've done everything we can to limit only those roles' access to that particular data. We don't have it open to the organization. We don't have stuff that's sitting in places where it shouldn't be sitting. We're removing stuff that we shouldn't hold on to, because we're reducing the attack surface. It just means that that ability to detect and investigate is so much quicker and so much more targeted. Otherwise, we're forever playing catch up. It's a combination of lots of layers, but I would always emphasize we have to look at what the end goal is, and that is the data.
That brings us back to something we were talking about earlier, the issue of users, cloud, applications, and devices. One of the biggest challenges is tracking what applications that user has access to. What applications is that user storing data in, be that Box, Dropbox, OneDrive, or any of dozens of different online file stores or collaboration systems? We see a lot of users pulling down files and putting them into a shared space because that works with the collaboration engine that that team utilizes. How easy is it to make that connection between user A and storage spaces 1, 2, 3, 9, 15, user B, who might overlap on some of those storage spaces or have totally different storage spaces?
You have to tackle it, I'm afraid. There are different ways of tackling it. You can make it easy for yourself. There's a multitude of different applications and data stores out there that are accessible and used. There's a fine balance between turning it all off and locking it all down and restricting it and feel like you have control with making it available and collaborative, but also having the controls in place to monitor it. I would say embrace these cloud technologies and these applications, and people have to use them as part of their job. Don't turn it off completely, because people will find a way. Shadow IT will creep in and people will find a way of accessing these things. My advice is to look at the estate, look at the applications and the data stores that you really do need to use, and just make sure that you have answers to fundamental questions for all of them. If we're going to provide OneDrive, if we're going to provide Dropbox, if we're going to provide application A, B, or C, can we ensure that we have all the governance we need to monitor those? Then we can allow our employees to use them and collaborate and be as productive as they need to be. But I know that I have the controls in place, rather than just saying, just use whatever you need to use and then you can share the data, because we lose control very, very quickly.
One of the reasons why I focused in on this is because we've seen Emotet do a lot of spreading via SMB. We've seen it spreading from user to user. And that's not always necessarily by just tracking them through the network. If you can drop an infected file on one user's account that is shared with other people, chances are other people will click on that file and opening it if you make it look attractive enough or you put it into the right place.
Absolutely.
How do we begin to make users aware of the risk here? And how do we track so that we can react in real time when we see that sort of behavior from malware like Emotet?
Two things. The first one is we have to continually ensure that we are making security front and center. I've done IT security for 20 years and organizations have been trying to do this for 20 years. We mustn't give up. We must make sure that people are aware. They are questioning everything they're doing in terms of opening up files and attachments, and user awareness training is really the first line of defense. Secondly, it comes down to looking at how data activity is shaping. We have to make sure that we capture everything we need to know. If I think about Emotet, I have to make sure I'm monitoring email, credentials and access within AD and Azure. I have to make sure I'm understanding how protocols and applications are being used. I have to make sure I capture sensitive intellectual information, and I have to then combine all of that. If we're not looking at these streams of information, we have black holes and we have areas that will be exploited. It comes down to user awareness training that has to continually evolve, and it has to be relevant and it has to be pertinent and it has to be understood by the employee. But also capturing all of that telemetry that we need, because that's the only way we're ever going to be able to spot any type of activity like this.
I said earlier there were two things you'd mentioned. The second we've just come back to, and that is the volume of information we need to capture. And I can hear the thudding of heads from people in socks as they smack their head on the wall at this moment in time. Because quite frankly, the amount of information they capture at the moment is virtually impossible to deal with effectively. The amount of data they could capture exceeds their capability to handle. It exceeds the capability of many of their tools to handle in any form of near real-time, let alone real-time environment. What are the easiest wins they can get from automation, and how do they begin to deploy that?
Another one that you didn't touch on, which I will just raise, is the cost associated with this as well. We have to store this stuff somewhere. It builds up very, very quickly. We have to invest in technologies that are in a position to run artificial intelligence, machine learning. We have to employ these techniques to be able to inspect the amount of information that we're capturing. When I speak to any analyst who works in a SOC, the one thing that they cry out for more than anything isn't more alerts. Of course, they don't want more alerts. They want enriched contextual alerts that actually have meaning, because then I know what to do with it. And I don't want to be having to then go off, investigate a multitude of different systems and bring them all back together to be able to paint a picture for me. What I would love to have is something that arrives in an inbox or arrives on a dashboard that I'm looking at, that tells me everything I need to know to determine how much priority I put on it. This individual was suddenly opened up information that is completely atypical to them and also their peers. And when, by the way, this information contains a high concentration of financial information. Then very, very quickly, we saw them access an external storage website and we saw an unusual amount of information being uploaded. Now, to me as an analyst, if I receive that, I know what direction to take quite quickly. This has to be the way we tackle this. Please don't think that we have to ingest everything. If I have everything, then I as a human being can then interpret, make decisions, because as you've just pointed out, you can't. You have to have intelligent systems like user behavioral tools that actually look at behavior, build up patterns, and then they're then able to spit out meaningful, high fidelity alerts that enable you to then make a decision of how much priority we put on this.
But one of the things we've seen with Emotet and with other pieces of malware is their ability to use things like PowerShell and to automate portions of their attack. At the same time, we're encouraging users to use PowerShell and to use scripting languages to speed up what they do, automate the mundane, have more time to deal with what will generate revenue for the business. But we have no way of constantly identifying, scanning, and picking up what's a good piece of automation, what's a bad piece of automation. We don't need more tools in cybersecurity. We're drowning under tools. So how do we make the tools we've got at the moment identify these attacks and become more effective?
We join the dots. We have to look at them as part of a picture. A very, very common technique is just to use the lie of the land, the tools that are available. And PowerShell is very, very common. Running reconnaissance using PowerShell to query things like Active Directory may in itself not fire anything suspicious. But if I then see queries running from PowerShell that are doing, for example, reverse DNS lookups, thousands of requests in a short space of time to identify what are data stores and what are IP addresses to printers that give me targets. But we have to join the dots between what just happened. Someone did a quick reconnaissance of AD, then maybe done a DC shadow attack. Who knows what they've done? But then within correlation, we've seen this other thing that's happened from that same machine underneath the same account. And then we may see an escalation of privileges. Now we're seeing a different account running from PowerShell on the same machine. But we have to join the dots together, because that's the only way we can determine what is potentially malicious and what isn't potentially malicious, because activities in their own may not be determined as bad.
If I look at this as an attacker, I can go out and buy all these libraries. I can take advantage of Emotet to deploy my attack. I can even use other parts of their platform as part of my attack. And everything is written in an open, almost easy to assemble way. When I look at the security industry, I see exactly the opposite, because people are focused on retaining customers, on revenue generation, and there's often a lack of open interfaces and integration between vendors. How does the industry become more attacker-like?
Attacker-like, I like that. You're right, it's a lot better than it used to be. There's an immense amount of security products out there, And there is some overlap between them, but a lot of them are complementary. We tend to struggle in the noise of marketing when everything sounds as though it does everything and everything else sounds like it does everything. The first thing we have to tackle is we have to be quite articulate in explaining exactly what it is that we do and where we fit in the kill chain. That is really important because that makes it easy for organizations to determine what parts of this particular attack I would know about, which bits I wouldn't know about. Alliances have grown hugely between vendors. I think we're certainly getting better. But there are also platforms out there that can correlate and bring together multiple parts of these to give you that succinct picture. SIEMs, obviously, really vital, important part of any level of being able to determine and run some forensics or even ideally in real time spot an attack. But a SIEM in itself is only as good as the information that you give it. If you can give it intelligent, contextual information from disparate systems, then you then pull it all together in one view. That's one way of actually tackling this. But we've got a long way to go in terms of opening up platforms. There's a lot of intellectual property that these vendors want to protect. If we can get to a point where we can get as much out of them as we can in terms of enrichment and then have some sort of consolidation in the middle that's saying, put it all together and give us that determination of what's going on, it will help us greatly. Bit of a conservative answer, I think. Sorry.
I think perhaps the one thing that is in our favour at this moment in time is that Emotet seems to come in short bursts and then go away, which gives us a chance to recover or to look to see what's coming. Perhaps what we need to do is spend more time in those quiet phases looking for its recon, looking for what it may be doing next.
Yeah, I think you've got a valid point there.
Matt, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's been a pleasure.